KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Former Secretaries of State Henry Kissinger and George Shultz called for an end to nuclear weapons a few years ago, but the movement failed to gain a foothold. So why do countries continue to spend billions of dollars to modernize and expand their nuclear arsenals? And what would make nuclear disarmament possible? Ward Wilson joins us to talk about his book, Five Myths of Nuclear Weapons. He's senior fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum program. Ward Wilson joins us in the studio for this forum hour, a senior fellow at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies of the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He's the author of Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons, a book in which he maintains that everything we think we know about nuclear weapons is wrong. And we welcome Ward Wilson to this forum hour. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
Well, I'm not going to fall into that pun about saying there's explosive stuff in this book, but indeed there is. I guess the first thing that I'm struck by is the fact that I know you want to have a national conversation about nuclear weapons, and I think it's important because we haven't been having that conversation. It was a while back that George Shultz and William Perry and Sam Nunn and Kissinger all got together and said, you know, it's time to get rid of these things. President Obama said, in effect, the same thing in Prague, 2008. Where's the conversation?
I agree that I think it's difficult to remember that nuclear weapons are dangerous because they're tucked away in silos and we never see them and no one tests above ground and no one tests very much at all except for the North Koreans. So, yeah, it's hard to remember that it's an issue that matters. But experience in life teaches us that sometimes stuff that emerges out of nowhere can matter a lot. And I think that's nuclear weapons.
Well, those of us who grew up in the duck and cover era and all that feel that it matters cataclysmically. It matters a whole lot. But let me get right to the heart of what you bring forward in your book, because a lot of it is what I suppose would come under the category of historical revisionism. I mean, the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the American notion is that led to the surrender of the Japanese. You say otherwise.
Yes. But before we do that, I just want to say that there's a revisionists in the context of Hiroshima are a particular group, and I don't want to associate necessarily with that. Revisionists say that the bomb forced Japan to surrender, but it was immoral. And it started in 1964 with Gar Alperovitz, and it's had a long and distinguished roster of people who've argued for it and against it.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. I didn't want to mean that kind of revisionism because that's not where you are.
Okay. So, on Hiroshima, what happened is that the Japanese leadership had been – their country had been bombed all summer long. We bombed 66 cities with conventional weapons and destroyed them pretty effectively. And we bombed two more cities, and it just didn't matter to them that much strategically. But the same day that we bombed Nagasaki, the Soviets, who had been neutral, came into the war. And that mattered a great deal to their strategic calculations because it brought an extra 1.5 million men into the war, and it meant that Japan could be invaded in as few as 14 days from the north. So they thought about whether they wanted to surrender. I presume they thought about whether they wanted to surrender to the Soviets or to us, and they said, we'll surrender to the U.S. But they blamed the surrender on the bomb because it made a great explanation for having lost the war. We lost the war not because we were stupid or we weren't brave enough or the soldiers made mistakes, but because the enemy invented a miracle weapon, and, you know, who could have expected that?
Well, it's also something that continues to loom, you know, mushroom clouds and all that, although what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki may be a firecracker compared to what we have now, and it's certainly faded from memory, but there's a great deal of that fear, and it goes right to the idea of mutual assured destruction. I mean, the idea that nuclear weapons have kept us safe.
Yeah, the fear is the biggest thing, it seems to me, and I think that what's happened is that nuclear weapons are clearly dangerous. They're clearly destructive. But we assume, partly because of Hiroshima, but partly because of the fear, that they have this magic ability, this psychological capability to deter and coerce others. And what I've been doing in part is to go back over the historical record, and what you find is that, yes, people are afraid of nuclear weapons. Is there some sort of magic fear that you can control and direct like a laser beam and it's reliable? And, you know, is nuclear deterrence a tool that you can take out of the toolbox whenever you want and it will accomplish the task? It doesn't appear to me to be so. It seems to me that nuclear weapons are dangerous, but not so useful as we think.
Well, let's go back historically again to another point, and that's the Berlin crisis. Planes were sent by President Truman, planes that couldn't even bomb, as you point out. But the distinct effect was the end of the 15-month blockade.
Stalin cuts off access to Berlin. Truman wants to do something. He sends B-29 bombers to England, and word of it, quote-unquote, leaks out. And everyone has since assumed that it was a nuclear threat. In fact, people in the Truman administration afterwards wrote memos about how effective this nonverbal threat was in affecting the crisis. Problem is that nothing happens for 8-9 months after the threat. The threat is early on in the crisis. It takes 11 months for it to get resolved. And the other question is, what about Stalin? Stalin is initiating a crisis with the United States at a time when the U.S. has a monopoly on nuclear weapons. If nuclear weapons deter, why didn't they deter Stalin from even starting the crisis? It might have boiled up into war.
And there's a whole new take, not only in your book, but from other books that have come out in the 50-year anniversary of Cuba by the Cuban Missile Crisis, and a very different narrative, to be sure. I mean, some of these books that I've read excerpts from say essentially it was really much more about the politics of the Cold War than it was about the United States being threatened by a nuclear standoff, although it did turn into a kind of nuclear standoff. And there's this story about Soviet Captain Valentin Savitsky ordering a firing of nuclear torpedoes. We came much closer to nuclear weapons being used in that than we even thought we did.
Absolutely. I was sitting in the office of a Harvard professor and arguing about nuclear deterrence, and he said, you know, well, but Ward, the Cuban Missile Crisis proves that deterrence works because the Russians put the missiles in, there was a risk of nuclear war, and then they took them out. And I wasn't sure what to say to that. And then, as always happens, about a month later, I thought of what I should have said, which is, what about Kennedy? Kennedy faced a situation in which he knew that if he blockaded Cuba, there was a risk of nuclear war. In fact, they mentioned that possibility 60 times in the secret XCOM committee meetings in the week before they announced their decision of what they were going to do. And yet Kennedy, rather than seeing the risk of nuclear war and drawing back, Kennedy rushed forward. He said, okay, we'll blockade the island. We're going to threaten to invade. Maybe they were going to actually launch the invasion. We don't know. So it may be that Khrushchev's behavior seems to have been affected by nuclear weapons, although maybe not. Maybe he was just happy with the deal he got. But what about Kennedy? And what does that say about nuclear deterrence? And as I do research in the various crises in the book, what I see is that there were failures all along in various different crises. And if nuclear deterrence isn't perfect, if it can fail, none of those failures led to nuclear war. But if it can fail, and the result of a failure can be catastrophic nuclear war, it's much less of a reliable tool than we've been thinking it is.
The result also of a mistake. I remember Daniel Ellsberg saying on this program there at least 4 or 5 times, you know, and he would have been privy to this sort of information where we came very close to the nuclear brink, and we're right, what, at about 1 minute to midnight now? And we're talking to Ward Wilson, by the way, author of 5 Myths About Nuclear Weapons. Is it a myth, though, that the genie's out of the bottle and you can't put it back in?
Ah, I love the genie myth. So this argument has won debates for 50 years. People talk about nuclear weapons and raise concerns, and advocates or proponents of nuclear weapons shake their heads sadly and say, well, you can't stuff the nuclear genie back in the bottle. And the reason this argument works so well is that it's absolutely true. You can't disinvent nuclear weapons. it also happens to be specious. No technology is ever disinvented. Don't get me wrong, technology goes out of existence all the time. If you don't believe it, try to get tech support for any device that's more than 4 years old. But it goes out of existence not by being disinvented, but by either better technology comes along or people realize it was dumb technology to begin with and it falls out of use. Can I tell the penny farthing?
Sure.
Okay. So remember penny farthing bicycles? They're the one big tire in front and one small wheel in back. And they were very popular bicycles in the 1890s. But they were difficult to get up on and dangerous to fall off of. No one stood around and said, well, you can't stuff the penny farthing genie back in the bottle. When better bicycles came along, penny farthings just went away by themselves. They didn't be disinvented. So the question about nuclear weapons is not, can they be disinvented or not? That's obviously, they can't be disinvented. Nothing can be. The question is it good technology? Is it technology that's so good that it will continue to be useful over time? And on the face of it, that seems unlikely since for almost 70 years, no one has found a situation in war or peacetime where they said to themselves, you know, using a nuclear weapon would be exactly the right tool to use in this situation.
Well, I also love the example of South Africa because, I mean, for a number of reasons, a lot of people thought South Africa is going to have to be, given the division and apartheid, there's going to have to be horrible carnage and blood and war and so forth, and yet somehow this country managed to avoid all that. But they also managed to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And you have the example in your book about Kazakhstan, what had was third in the world in terms of nuclear weaponry. Now, a lot of them have gone over to the Russians, but they just decided to simply turn them over and not be nuclear anymore.
A lot of people don't realize that there are more countries that had nuclear weapons in hand or had programs to build nuclear weapons and got rid of them than have built nuclear weapons. So there are 9 countries that have built nuclear weapons. There are 12 to 15, depending on how you count, nations that had the weapons, thought about it, and said, this is not useful. I had dinner with a brigadier general in the South African Defense Forces. He was telling me about an exercise they asked him to do. You know, imagine South Africa's attacked by 3 armies and you have these defense forces and 6 nuclear weapons, which at the time they did. What's your defense plan? He said, I thought about it for a week and then I decided I'll use the defense forces and keep the nuclear weapons in the closet because there's nothing practical that I can do with them. And so that's part of the reason why I think South Africa got rid of them. Kazakhstan sits between 2 nuclear powers, Russia and China. And realist theory ought to, you know, predict that Kazakhstan would keep the nuclear weapons they inherited when the Soviet Union broke up. But they didn't. They were quite adamant about getting rid of their nuclear weapons.
But there's still this notion that, in fact, I think Stephen Cohen wrote about it in a review he did of your book. He said, one of the myths is perhaps it needs to be put out on the table here is the importance of Gorbachev as opposed to Reagan in terms of dismantling the Cold War. But the other one he talked about was the fact that countries do see nuclear weapons as deterrents. I'm sure that North Korea sees their nuclear weapons as a way of deterring or protecting themselves against South Korea. I'm sure that Iran sees themselves as protecting themselves against the United States and Israel.
Part of the problem with nuclear weapons is, the way to think about it is to think about money. Money is funny stuff. You know, it's paper with some ink and some pictures and numbers on it. And yet we value money enormously. We work late and don't spend time with our families. And, you know, people get shot in alleys because they won't give up their money. And the reason we value money is because as a group, we've decided to value these objects as the highest value or one of the high values. There's group social construction of the value of money. The fact is that can happen with weapons too. And after World War II, when the United States said, these are miracle weapons, people said, wow, nuclear weapons are the currency of power. if you want to be a powerful country, you have to have this currency. And it may or may not have anything to do with how useful the weapons are, whether they're practical or too large for almost any circumstance.
Forgive me, it's almost a sense of national honor in many cases, really.
We talk about this among ourselves on nuclear weapons people, and we agree that the last country to give up nuclear weapons will not be Pakistan, will not be Israel. It will be France. Because nuclear weapons are so inextricably linked in the identity of France that, the French really, really want to keep the weapons, I think. So it's I think this the symbolic power of nuclear weapons is undeniable. If you want to argue that they're militarily useful and politically reliable, we could have a debate.
We're talking again, if you just joined us, with Ward Wilson. His book is Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. It's a book, by the way, that is the ideas that have been embraced by some rather major names in the field of research and positions on nuclear weaponry: Freeman Dyson, Jonathan Schell, Richard Rhodes. And there's also the whole idea of the apocalypse. You bring this out, the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita, and not only the apocalypse, but Armageddon. And you say it's unlikely to resemble, if nuclear weapons are used, those kind of biblical prophecies, more likely move us back into the Dark Ages or something along those lines. But these have played a central role in this mythic notion of nuclear weaponry.
Absolutely. You know, we think about it. When we talk about nuclear war, the name we give it, when you don't call it nuclear war, what do you call it? You could call it super science war because it's high tech. You could call it mega death war because a lot of people would die. You could even call it wargasm, which is the name that Herman Kahn made up. But we don't call it that.
Before or after Helen Caldicott wrote about missile envy?
I think it was before. But when we talk about nuclear war, typically we name it by the name of a hill in Israel that in the Bible is the site of the last battle at the end of days. We call it Armageddon. And it is evidence of the symbolic and mythic nature of nuclear weapons, that instead of just talking about nuclear war and thinking about how horrible it would be and understanding it at a practical level, we tend to slip into this biblical it's not just the Bible. There are apocalypse myths in many cultures.
I mentioned the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah. So the question is, the thing to remember when thinking about nuclear weapons is we had a choice between thinking practically about nuclear war and its consequences or thinking mythically. And when we had that choice, we grabbed the myth with both hands. So how realistic is what we've been thinking about these weapons?
You have a view that kind of undercuts a lot of your book, that war is deeply rooted in human nature, that the peace that we've had, for example, is not necessarily the result of, we've had wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, we've had wars all over the world, but that there's a myth of a kind of peace resulting from nuclear weaponry. And yet I think you make the argument, and correct me if I'm not presenting it in the way you feel it's most accurate, but that it is not only deeply rooted in our nature, but that soldiers fall and die in wars. And that's the way wars are generally fought, and wars are won or lost, not necessarily by these kind of weapons or the possession even of these weapons.
What nuclear weapons do, several things. I'm a pragmatist and a historian, and so I look back at history and I see war as a durable and persistent part of human civilization. I don't like that, but I see that as a reality. So when I think about nuclear weapons, I am concerned that there will be a war in the future and that it will be fought with nuclear weapons. So I'm sorry, now I've forgotten the first part of the question.
Well, the whole question about whether or not wars are averted because of nuclear weaponry.
I think
you've been saying consistently they are.
Well,
they are not, excuse me.
Yeah, we look at the last 60 years, and there has been no major war in Europe. and no war between the United States and Russia or the Soviet Union before. And some people say, wow, this is great. It's really wonderful, and it must be caused by something specific. So maybe that's nuclear weapons. They're keeping us safe. They're preventing war. But there's considerable evidence that, for instance, throughout history, there have often simply been periods of peace. From 1815 to 1848, there were 33 years of history that had nothing to do – 33 years of peace that had nothing to do with nuclear weapons. The Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, had a 200-year span of peace, but none of those things are necessarily have to do with nuclear weapons. It seems to me that and what's most troubling is that people have made this sort of mistake before. In the 1890s, the Victorians congratulated themselves on how civilized they were. They noticed that there were fewer and fewer wars in Europe, that the wars were getting shorter. They decided that there was a technological explanation for that because of trains and telegraphs. Wars were shorter. And they said, there'll never be another major war in Europe. We're heading into a period of uninterrupted peace. World War I disabused them of that notion with a savage fury. And when I read this evidence from the past, it makes me concerned that perhaps, not necessarily, but perhaps, we're making that same mistake.
And since you're a self-proclaimed pragmatist, how much are we spending in terms of nuclear weapons and the maintenance of nuclear weapons now?
Well, it's difficult to know because the government doesn't aggregate spending on nuclear weapons. It's put in various different places throughout the federal government, in the Department of Energy and Department of Defense and various other places, cleanup efforts and so on. There was a study in 2008 that said something like $52 billion
a year.
That's
the figure I saw.
Yeah. But the thing to keep in mind is that from 1945 to 1996, the 50-year period, we spent $5.5 trillion, with a T, dollars on nuclear weapons. It was the third largest chunk of spending, government spending that we did. You could double three other categories if you hadn't spent that money on nuclear weapons. That's a lot of hospitals and school buses and remedial education and workers' training.
Well, as I said earlier, Ward Wilson wants a national conversation to begin about the usefulness of nuclear weapons and really how practical, useful, or effective are they. I'll put that question out to you, our listeners, and also ask you, do you think nuclear weapons have kept us safe? Because certainly he makes a case for just the opposite. And should the United States start thinking about disarming? As I said earlier, President Obama said back in 2008 in Prague that that's the course or the trajectory we should move along, but it doesn't necessarily seem to be one we're on. You may want to join us, and please feel free to do that. We welcome your phone calls, and we welcome your participation in this conversation with any questions or comments you might have. You can join us now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your phone calls, and our toll-free number to join us now is 866-733-6786. A number of other ways you can communicate with us. You can simply email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or you can communicate with us by going to our Facebook page or tweeting us, and our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. We'll hear from you when we return. Our guest, Ward Wilson, his book, Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. Our guest this hour is Ward Wilson. His book is Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons, and we certainly invite you to join this conversation, which is really a conversation about nuclear weapons, how important they are, how purposeful they are, how they serve this country or countries that have them. And by the way, I want to sort of update you on a few things before we go to your calls and emails, which I want to do forthwith. And again, you can join us at our toll-free number at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. I wanted, however, to update you on a few things. You may, of course, be aware of the fact that John Kerry is now the Secretary of State, has been named Secretary of State. And one of the things he said in testifying for his confirmation that ties in with our discussion with Ward Wilson this morning is that he would do whatever is necessary to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. That's a direct quote. We also have some new news out of North Korea, which, as you know, is a nuclear state. And David Straub is Associate Director of Korean Studies Program with the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center at Stanford. He was Director of the Office of Korean Affairs at the State Department. And David Straub, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you, Michael.
This is sounding pretty ominous with North Korea. They've vowed more nuclear testing, but they also threatened the United States as a sworn enemy.
Yes, that's right. The North Korean top government office, the National Defense Commission, today has issued a statement in which they say that they will conduct a nuclear test of, quote, higher level, unquote. They don't say when. They say they will target against the U.S., the sworn enemy of the Korean people.
And the United States' response has been essentially, well, obviously to condemn this, but also to make it clear that its long-range rockets are designed to carry warheads aimed at striking the United States, and therefore the United States is going to do or should do what?
Well, the United States has been working with the international community for a long time, and the thing that immediately prompted this statement was a UN Security Council resolution passed earlier this week that that did, in fact, condemn the recent North Korean rocket launch. And this is typical of the North Koreans. They respond to international pressure and condemnations by making further threats. Unfortunately, in the past, after UN Security Council resolutions against their missile programs, they have twice conducted nuclear tests. So the speculation is that in fact, they will test another nuclear device, and probably fairly soon.
How do you assess the threat from North Korea? I mean, this is obviously provocative, but they've made pretty provocative statements in the past, not only targeted at the United States, but also at South Korea. And yet, how much of the threat is really there as we can assess it?
Well, the threat against South Korea is a very serious threat, because of the nuclear program, but because of their conventional forces. North Korea is one of the most militarized societies on the planet, and it's quite belligerent. And just a couple of years ago, they, in fact, attacked South Korea twice, sinking a ship, killing 46 young men in a sneak attack. And then at the end of 2010, they launched an artillery attack on a South Korean island, killing four people. So that threat is very real, and there's always the risk of a war breaking out because everything is on hair trigger. The nuclear program is different. The nuclear program, I don't think anyone seriously believes that the North Koreans intend to strike the United States or any other country, but I think they use it to bolster their popularity at home, to show how tough and successful they are with this prestige program. And externally, they use it to try to change the strategic landscape to make other countries accept their program and in the process also give them unilateral aid.
We've also got a new leader of North Korea, and this comes on the heels of the inauguration of the President of the United States. What about the timing of that in terms of leadership?
Well, I think they probably were prepared to test a nuclear device last year. At the beginning of last year, they tested a rocket, and it failed. And I think that may have been a factor in their deciding not to test a nuclear device then. We can speculate that perhaps they want to test a nuclear device again just before the inauguration of the new South Korean president next month, and also just around the time of the inauguration of President Obama, to send a message about how tough they are and that we should negotiate on their terms.
David Straub, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Straub, Associate Director of Korean Studies Program at the Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center at Stanford, and he is former director of the Korean Affairs at the State Department between 2002 and 2004. Ward Wilson, your thoughts about North Korea?
Well, I want to be careful because I would like my country to be safe, as everyone would. But I think that my reading of nuclear weapons is that they are fearsome looking, but not. It's very difficult to imagine a practical situation in which you can actually use them. And I think every country that gets nuclear weapons, this is thinking ahead to Iran, which I guess we're going to talk about, it increases the danger of the world, because the more countries that have nuclear weapons, the more chance for a war, the more chance for a terrorist to steal a weapon from somewhere. But I think that what will happen when the Iranians get nuclear weapons, if they decide to build nuclear weapons, is that they'll find what everyone else has found when they acquired their nuclear arsenal, that it's prestigious, but not something that has much practical value. I mean, consider that if nuclear weapons are going to allow Iran to dominate the Middle East, why didn't they allow Israel to dominate the Middle East for the last 40 years?
There are five myths that are detailed in Ward Wilson's new book. Myth number one, nuclear weapons shock and awe opponents. He shows that the Soviet Union's declaration of war pressed Japan to surrender rather than America's nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Myth number two, the H-bomb quantum leap. Most people believe modern nukes would destroy thousands of times as large an area as the bombs dropped on Japan. Not true. Myth number three, nuclear deterrence works in a crisis, which we've talked about. Myth number four, nuclear weapons keep us safe, which we have talked about. And myth number five, there is no alternative, which this is really what we'll hear maybe from some of you. Let me go to your calls, in fact, and we begin with Bodhi. Good morning.
Good morning. One thing that it seems like the world is just, we're realizing how small it is and how we really can't afford to use, no one can afford to use nuclear weapons, and it seems like, to me, the only clear path is for the U.S. to take a really firm stand and lead by example by beginning a program for disarmament.
Well, what about disarmament and the realistic possibility of it as you see things, Ward Wilson? As I said, President Obama spoke in Prague as if this was definitely in his sights, so to speak. But all those programs, nuclear free zones and SANE, and they seem to have also kind of vanished.
Well, there's no question that we don't think about nuclear weapons as much as we used to. In terms of unilateral disarmament, I confess that I'm of two minds. My friend Freeman Dyson says, you know, unilateral disarmament is exactly the way to go, that all the major steps in nuclear weapons, the retirement of tactical nuclear weapons by George Bush Sr. and others were the result of unilateral action by leaders. And there's something to be said for that. But I think that politically it's just too difficult, particularly in the United States, to do anything except have everyone come down together. And that said, I think Bodhi's right. I think that the United States should take the lead. And the first step, from my perspective, is that we need to – the first step is to get everyone to see that nuclear weapons – to rethink nuclear weapons, to devalue them and point out that we're no longer making them the centerpiece of our arsenals. And I think that the example of the United States matters. And if the U.S. says they're not as important as we once thought, we think they're clumsy, that will have an impact around the world.
The United States also has such an excessive surfeit number of nuclear weapons.
Well, yes.
How many nuclear weapons do we need, especially since we outnumber every nation on Earth disproportionately? Rich writes, I would invite every person listening to take a trip to Hiroshima, Japan, to stand at the site of our use of weapons of this type. I don't change my mind often, but I signed a petition using the elimination of these weapon systems after an hour in the museum in Peace Memorial Park there. I could not imagine bombs many times larger than the one used to cremate that city. One look at the memorial to the children killed there did it for me. Let me just read another email or two here. We get an email from a listener, Andrew, who writes, Albert Einstein was asked after World War II how he thought the next war would be fought, and he said he couldn't say, but that the one after that would be fought with stones, which kind of, I guess, dovetails with what your belief is, Ward Wilson, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Ernst says, I've always puzzled over the problem of how nuclear weapons could be tactically useful. I'd love to get your guest perspective on this issue. Are there any situations in which a nuclear weapon could accomplish a useful tactical goal that conventional forces couldn't?
Well, I've talked to some military men, and what's striking about that is how often they, particularly Army military officers, are extraordinarily skeptical about the usefulness of nuclear weapons. And the only two uses that I've heard that make sense to me, the best use I can think of is if you had an invasion flotilla coming towards you, and they were tightly packed on the water, you could use a nuclear weapon to destroy the invasion flotilla. You don't get much radiation because the radiation is attached to water droplets that fall back into the ocean instead of going downwind.
Well, it gets in our ecosystem, gets in the ocean.
Well, I'm just saying that of the bad possibilities, it is the least bad. But And I don't argue that nuclear weapons are useless because, you know, there's always the chance of an asteroid coming from outer space or something. But I think the question we have to ask ourselves is, do the one or two military uses that make sense, are they enough to counterbalance the enormous danger that the weapons pose?
Let's hear from another of our callers. And Henry, join us. You're on. Hi.
Morning, Michael. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask the professor, the Lord, a question, please. We live in a brave new world since 9/11, an insidious world where terrorists can attack at any time at their choosing. My question to you is, don't you think that Hezbollah, Hamas, organizations like that would gladly, joyfully use a weapon of mass destruction on Israel, which the Ayatollahs have called a one-bomb country? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. We thank you for the question. What do you think, Ward Wilson?
Thank you, Henry. I think what I always say about terrorists is that if you want to ensure that terrorists get a nuclear weapon, what you should do is continue on exactly as we are doing now. Because it seems to me that what's happening is that nuclear weapons are slowly but relatively surely spreading to more and more countries. And the more countries that have nuclear weapons, the more chances there are for an AQ Khan or whomever to pass a nuclear weapon out the back door or something.
So, AQ Khan was the Pakistani nuclear scientist who sold a lot of secrets probably all over the world, literally.
Yes.
But those weapons are also pretty vulnerable. You know, we just found out in the raid on that natural gas place in a company, a factory, whatever it was, in Algeria that was taken over by terrorists, and many were killed, hostages as well as terrorists. They had very little guards, and we're talking about nuclear weapons that are in silos that are not necessarily by any means well-guarded.
When I spoke in Washington, a nun, Sister Agnes, came, who was one of the people who was arrested breaking into the Y-12 facility in Tennessee. This is a nuclear weapons facility that, is very sensitive and supposedly very secure. And these activists got in. And the large corporation that manages the facility lost its contract because people should not be allowed to wander around in sensitive nuclear facilities. So I think even in the United States, it's difficult to keep these weapons completely locked down.
Mike writes on our Facebook page, you cannot separate the weapon from the economy and industry that produces it. Having the technology and means to make the devices is a symbol of might in its own right. It may be hollow might, but if others believe Russia and the U.S. have many, many more nuclear devices and their delivery systems than all the rest of the world put together, the U.S. and Russia must build their stockpile, down their stockpiles first before they have any moral authority whatsoever to tell anyone else what to do.
I think there are two pieces there, and I agree with Mike that the U.S. and Russia have to start, that obviously the large stockpiles need to come down. Then when you get to a level where everyone's relatively near to each other, then you can go further. I'm not sure he exactly said this, but let me say that people often say, well, Ward, you may be right that nuclear weapons are not that useful, but they have this reputation now. The reputation is the reality. And so we have to live in this world of reputation. And when I hear that, I always think of Patroclus, Achilles' best friend in the Iliad. You may remember that Achilles, they took his girl and he decided he wasn't going to fight. He sat in his tent and he sulked. I won't fight. I won't fight. And the Achaeans started losing. The Trojans were winning. The Achaeans were taking losses. People went to Achilles' tent and they said, please, you have to fight. He said, I won't fight. I won't fight. Finally, Patroclus goes and says, if you won't fight, let me take your armor and the famous shield, and I will go in your place. And Achilles says, okay. Patroclus goes out, he appears on the field, and for a while, the reputation of Achilles carries the day. The Trojans fall back. The Achaeans begin to win. Then Hector says, Achilles or no, I have to go out and challenge him. And he goes out on the battlefield. And then Apollo sneaks up behind Patroclus and knocks him down. He's not hurt, but his helmet comes off. And the Trojans see that it is not, in fact, Achilles. And they run him through with spears. The moral for me of this story is that reputation is an unreliable defense in war. I don't want my country defended by a hollow suit of armor, by a reputation. I want Achilles. I want the real warrior to defend me. So I worry about arguments that say we can rely on the reputation of nuclear weapons. If we can't rely on the weapons to actually be useful, then I think we shouldn't.
Our guest is Ward Wilson. His book is Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. We've asked our listeners on Facebook if they think the U.S. should disarm its nuclear weapons. John writes, probably, since only one country has ever used a nuclear weapon against another country. And looking at a tweet here from Ted, who writes, I wonder if your guest could speak to nuclear arms programs as bargaining chips versus currency of power.
There's no question that people use nuclear weapons as bargaining chips. The North Koreans are
masters. North Koreans
are
a prime example.
Yeah, and I would guess, and in some ways, Iran, although they're not getting concessions, they're actually getting clamped down on. They've used nuclear weapons to draw attention and to, you know, insert themselves into the international debate. So I think that that's right. The symbolic value of this currency is very great.
It's also great in the sense of being, for example, with Israel and Iran, an existential threat. I mean, Benjamin Netanyahu has said, you know, we need the United States to help us, in effect, stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. This would mean the possibility of the extinction of the State of Israel, and it would mean the possibility, in other words, of our survival no longer being tenable. Put on that level. How does that resonate for you?
Well, it is the classic problem with nuclear weapons. They allow you to threaten the existence of another state. Certainly when the U.S. and the Soviet Union had, you know, 20,000 nuclear weapons on either side, they were in a similar position. I will say that there are three practical problems with attacking Israel with nuclear weapons. The first is that Israel has a lot of Palestinians living in it. And although there's not a particular amount of love lost between Persians and Arabs, killing a lot of Palestinians will not make you friends in the Middle East if you're the Iranians. Second problem is that an attack on Israel wouldn't really be complete without an attack against Jerusalem. But Jerusalem is the site of the second holiest shrine in Islam. And if your goal as the leading Shia country is to assume the mantle of the leadership of all Islamic peoples around the world, destroying the second holiest shrine is not helpful. And finally, the problem with attacking Israel with nuclear weapons is that the Middle East is small, relatively, and the wind blows. So that an attack on Israel might well end up in hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands of people dead in Damascus or Beirut or even Cairo. And so nuclear weapons have fundamental limitations as weapons. And the Iranians, no country has yet ever committed national suicide. And if the Iranians really wanted to commit suicide, they could do it today. They could make a chemical weapons attack against Israel, which would certainly elicit a very strong counterattack by the U.S. and Israel and the rest of the world. And they wouldn't have to go to all the trouble of waiting and all the money and difficulty of building a nuclear program. If their goal was to, you know, self-immolate, they could do that right now.
Let me go to a couple of comments that have come onto our website. Hector writes, nuclear weapons are these days asymmetrical. In today's system, a major power like the United States, Russia, or China would suffer incredible international costs if they were to use a device. These weapons, however, give power to smaller nations and international criminal organizations disproportionate to their size. It is fundamentally in the national security interests of major military powers to ensure nuclear weapons are never used. For that to manifest itself in international disarmament, however, the major powers would have to trust each other, which I believe is a long way off. It would also require a commitment to go to war conventionally with anyone found in violation, i.e. the U.S. with Israel, Russia with Iran, and China with Pakistan and India. And another listener writes on our website, by definition, if the United States updates nuclear weapons that have passed their useful age, they will be actively proliferating nuclear bombs and be in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Well, I'm mostly with Hector. I think that nuclear weapons do give more power to small countries and organizations. I'm not as pessimistic about the prospects of doing something about it. It's certainly true that if nuclear weapons are magic, the other thing about the genie myth is that saying nuclear weapons, you can't stuff the nuclear genie back in the bottle, that implies something psychologically suggestive. That implies that in proponents' minds, nuclear weapons are the genie. They are magic. You bring out your nuclear weapon, you wave it around, and then...
Yeah, but the other central metaphor, going back to Greek mythology, which you used before, is Pandora's box.
Right. So if nuclear weapons are magic, then international disarmament is impossible. Everyone wants magic. No one will agree to get rid of it.
You're listening to Forum. We're talking with Ward Wilson, the author of 5 Myths About Nuclear Weapons, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And our next caller is Ruth. Ruth, join us.
Hi. I've often thought that nuclear weapons and the other heavy weapon systems that people say are impractical are doing their job, because their whole point is to make an awful lot of money for the people who manufacture them. So it doesn't matter whether they work or not. I'm putting work in quotation marks. It doesn't matter anything else, but the thing is incredible. The cost is the point. In nuclear weapons and many other weapon systems, it probably including all those heavy hand guns, and not just pistols and rifles, but those assault weapons and things. I know that's a separate subject, but the thing is that arms manufacturers make an awful lot of money.
No, there is great profiteering in weaponry and nuclear weapons just to maintain them, and the industries that are behind them are obviously profiting.
And Ruth, there's historical evidence to support your assertion, because the people in South Africa who pressed for the South Africans to build nuclear weapons were not the military. It was the industrial people and the lab scientists and so on who really wanted to press forward. So I think that the money-making factor here is really important. And in fact, the reason it was so difficult to pass the START Treaty is that the only people who really care about this issue are the people with a financial stake. And that may be why President Obama had to promise to, spend so much money on upgrading our nuclear weapons facilities in order to get those people to be willing to come along with the START Treaty.
And Ruth, we thank you for your call. Quote from your book, nuclear weapons are an anomaly, and we can therefore take practical steps to handle them without having to change everything. What are those practical steps?
Well, I think the first...
Aside from disarming, maybe.
I think that the practical steps are the first thing is psychological. We just have to stop imagining them looming over us and picturing them as mythical apocalypse. If we see them instead as big, clumsy, difficult to use, I love the metaphor of the bank guard. You want to guard your bank. What kind of weapon do you give the bank guard? Do you give him a gun or do you give him dynamite? What's he going to do with dynamite? It's so big. It's powerful, but it's so big it's not useful. I think that's...
Well, he can blow up the vault and take the money, I guess.
Well, but if a bad guy comes, are you going to blow up the bad guy and the teller and the customers and the lobby? As the bank guard, your job is to protect the money, not blow everything to smithereens. So I think the first step is to imagine nuclear weapons as the bull in the china shop rather than as, the rising... a cloud of apocalypse.
And Peter, you're on with us. Hi.
I don't know if you discussed this before because I missed the first part of the show, but I might beg to differ with that last reassuring statement based on the calculations and estimations of Alan Robach and his colleagues at Rutgers University. That's where Robach is. And they published in Nature magazine in a short but very impactful comment in 2011 May, that very much fewer weapons than actual explosions than normally thought might be needed to trigger nuclear winter. And the reason is they would act as fuses that would light off uncontrollable fires in major metropolitan areas, especially, for instance, India and Pakistan. And this soot would go all over the world and cause crop failures, if not immediate freezing of the entire population of the world. And so I do very much appreciate this show and this author, but I'd like to point that out. I'd also like to say that the development of democracy is arguably what prevented wars for so many years between the major powers. And remember the people-to-people efforts with media that were conducted by Beyond War and Internews and then picked up by ABC News, Capital to Capital. And
Peter, forgive me. I got to jump in here because we're running short on time. I want to hear Ward Wilson's response to your remarks.
Peter, Alan's a great guy, and I heard him present this at Princeton, and I find it persuasive. I'm not a scientist, so I don't argue about nuclear winter in the book. I argue from the facts of history by and large. But, you know, the stuff that Alan has done is impressive.
It goes back to Carl Sagan.
Well, yes, it begins with Sagan and Rich Turco and a group of people in the 80s, yes.
Well, I want to thank you, Ward Wilson. Good to have you with us. And by the way, actually, Ward Wilson will be speaking about his book at Books, Inc. in Berkeley tonight at 7 p.m. The book, again, Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. Pleased to have you on. Thank you for being here. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.